Welcome to The World Unspun. I'm your host, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. Today's guest is someone very important to me.
My name is Najla Mohammed Lamin. I am a Sahrawi refugee based on the refugee camps, the Sahrawi refugee camps in southwest Algeria.
I first met Najla in 2022. I was fresh out of grad school, having just completed my dissertation on digital activism in Western Sahara. I got a job working in communications with a UK charity that was running an after-school program for kids in the camps. Najla lives in Camp Smara, one of five camps that are home to around 200,000 people living in exile from Moroccan-occupied Western Sahara. Najla runs her own education and climate program for women and children in the camps. You'll hear her talk all about it later in the episode. In 2023, she was recognized for this work when she was named on the BBC's 100 Women, a list of the most inspiring and influential women from around the world. After I left the camps, Najla and I stayed in touch. I interviewed her for stories I wrote about the war in Western Sahara, and we became good friends. I visited her again in 2024 when I did the Sahara Marathon, an annual awareness-raising event. We stayed with Najla and her family in their home for a week, where we were shown incredible hospitality, kindness, and warmth. ...2025 marks 50 years since Morocco invaded Western Sahara, a former Spanish colony on the west coast of Africa.
We are not celebrating, we are mourning, you know, 50 years of exile, 50 years of living in such conditions, and to not know any future perspective of where is this going to take us.
In 1975, Morocco launched what it called the Green March, a campaign led by King Hassan II, where hundreds of thousands of unarmed Moroccan civilians marched into Western Sahara to demonstrate support for its annexation by Morocco and to reclaim the territory from Spanish control. The move triggered war with the Polisario Front, a political-military movement that claims representation of the Sahrawi people. Thousands of Sahrawis were forced to flee Morocco's systematic bombings with chemical weapons, seeking refuge across the border in Algeria. They walked for weeks in the desert with little more than the clothes on their backs. Exhausted and starving, they set up provisional camps and a state in exile.
I was born here, you know. My mom came when she was 6 years old, you know. And now she's almost 60, and I'm an adult, I'm a mom now, she's a grandmother, and we are still in these refugee camps.
Western Sahara is rich in natural resources, including phosphates, fish, wind, and solar energy. It's been the site of massive exploitation for over a century. Today, Morocco is being hailed as a rare climate change success story, but little has been said about how many of its renewable energy projects are being built in Western Sahara, forcibly displacing the Sahrawis. Morocco plans to produce more than half of its energy from renewable sources by 2030 and to export some of this energy abroad to the UK and Europe.
Morocco has truly one of the best solar and wind resources in the world combined, and it is very special.
In 2020, war returned to Western Sahara.
Over the weekend, fighting broke out in several areas between the Moroccan military and the Polisario Front, the Sahrawi liberation movement seeking independence.
In the last few days, the Polisario leader issued a decree ending a commitment to the nearly three-decade-long ceasefire over a border confrontation.
With little international media attention or action to resolve the ongoing conflict, a political solution that will allow the Sahrawis to return to their homeland seems further away than ever.
We are fed up. We have been fed up and we continue to be fed up by this reality and by this waiting and by this feeling of being forgotten, of being left, of being abandoned by the international community.
With all eyes on Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza and its killings and land theft in the West Bank, I wanted to invite Najla onto The World Unspun to talk about the parallels with the war in Western Sahara and where she derives hope for the future. I reached her just past midnight one evening in February. The internet connection, once stable, has gotten worse in recent months, Najla said. With her baby asleep in her arms, Najla spoke to me via WhatsApp. Stay tuned for our conversation. Hi, Najla.
Hi.
How are you? Is Mariam asleep?
Yes, she just so. Hopefully that will last.
I think for those that don't know the history of Western Sahara and the struggle of the Sahrawi people, and even for those that are new to the subject, I think so much of what little coverage does exist always starts from the sort of historical and political context. And while that's obviously really important, and we'll certainly touch on it over the course of the conversation, I actually think, you know, the work that you do and how we sort of got to know each other is such an interesting entry point into the Sahrawi struggle and the history of Western Sahara. So I actually want to start there. If you can maybe just describe what it is that you do in the camps and how you started this program, how it came to be.
I am working, running a community center since 2019. So we run three projects in this community center, one for children, and it's education, alternative education. And then we have a second program, which is women's health in general, mostly educating women about health and providing some simple supplies and resources. And then the third program is the environmental program, and we educate mainly children about the environment, but we also have a seed bank. We give seeds to people who are interested in seeds, who are interested in starting their own home gardens. This center started as an idea of mine when I was studying in the U.S., doing my degree on sustainable development. I wanted to combine my love for reading and the relationship I've had with books since I became a teenager, and also combine my degree at the time studying sustainable development. And I came up with this initiative, which is to create a library in the refugee camps to help children read from an early age. And took around 2 years the birth of the idea to the creation of the idea. And now we just had the celebration of 5 years of work.
And I know, having visited the center myself and seen, you know, firsthand the kids lining up, you know, before it even opens to get books and to learn to read and to spend time with each other. Can you talk a bit about, you know, for those that don't know, the Sahrawi refugee community has been largely dependent on international aid for the last 50 years, but even the aid that has been available has been slowly dwindling, and, you know, the resources are just so limited. Can you talk a bit about the need that your center fills in the community and what some of the challenges are that you face in running a program like this?
Just creating anything in this reality that we live in is like a miracle, really. Not only resource-wise, it's like also like the idea that you can create something in a refugee camp that is not stable, you know, that you don't know like how long we're going to be staying here. So I can't just like go to NGOs or like the government or ministers to ask for money to pay the workers and to run the, you know, our logistics, day-to-day logistics and needs. So it's very, very much dependent, like almost everything in the camps on like external supporters. But there are also a lot of challenges regarding the existence of this place in a refugee camp. For example, there's like a huge part of the year where we cannot open the center because it's extremely hot to do anything, you know. It's like almost three full months of the year we are closed, you know. And there are actually the months where the children need spaces like this the most because they are not in school. But we cannot work. And then, of course, we have our health program for women. And we do sensibilization about breast cancer, about breastfeeding. And we provide some supplies and some resources to make breastfeeding a journey less painful and less, you know, less difficult. But of course, we don't have much access to resources that are needed when it comes to breastfeeding. And also another challenge is that, okay, in our program for teaching women about breast cancer, we empower women to, you know, always like self-examine and everything. But then if they have suspicion that they have some lump or something, then where do they go? You know, we don't have access here in the camps for like mammograms or for, you know, like early examination of breast cancer. So it's like we are empowering women to do this first step, but then if something is there, actually, it will take them like, it could take them years to go to, you know, treatment.
And the climate element of the work that you do and the seed distribution bank is a really vital aspect of the Almasar Library Center. Can you talk a bit more about what the actual realities are for being able to grow healthy fruits and vegetables in those conditions? And can you also talk a bit about how the center itself has been adapted for the climate? Can you talk a bit about how you've been able to adapt the center and also be able to distribute seeds for fresh fruits and vegetables?
So our center is basically built in a sustainable way. 95% of it is sustainable. We used like natural material and like to build the center. We tried to design it in a way that is resistible to the heat and to the sandstorms and to the floodings. So far, these last 5 years, we've had few floodings and of course a lot of sandstorms. And thank God, during the day, we basically don't need electricity because for lights, because we designed it in a way that there's a lot of natural lights coming in. And we have a seed bank, and it's actually very demanded by people. We even created a community garden that is run by me and two other mothers. But the biggest challenge now, for example, this year we haven't started because we haven't had enough water to start the garden. How can you start a garden without water? You cannot. To grow food, there are some successful attempts, but there are very few. I think if we had some more reliable source of water, I think more and more people are interested in growing their own food for many reasons. One of them is the quality of the humanitarian aid. Second is the declining amount of humanitarian aid after the U.S. current president closing the U.S. aid. It's impacting the refugee camps directly. Huge impact. It's big part of our humanitarian aid is financed by U.S. aid, and Trump just decided not to. Since we are refugees and very poor refugees, we are always very, you know, vulnerable to all these changes. They affect us directly.
I think a lot of what we read about the Sahrawi struggle is this idea of resilience. But can you maybe talk, I mean, you mentioned this is now 2025 marks 50 years since Morocco invaded Western Sahara in 1975 and forced the Sahrawis to become refugees in Algeria. Can you talk a bit about the significance of this anniversary? I mean, what does 50 years of forced exile due to the Sahrawi people and to your political cause?
It's a big, big tragic, you know? It's big tragic to see. We are not celebrating, we are mourning, you know? 50 years of exile, 50 years of living in such conditions, and to not know any future perspective of where is this going to take us. It's not a celebration. It's really something to mourn, and it's really something to condemn, you know? Mm-hmm. I was born here, you know? My mom came when she was 6 years old, you know? And now she's almost 60. And I'm an adult. I'm a mom now. She's a grandmother. And we are still in these refugee camps. Peaceful resistance is the price of some nation that trusted the international community. We handed our future to the hands of the international community. And what they did, they let us live here for 50 years, you know. I can only say that we are fed up. We have been fed up, and we continue to be fed up by this reality and by this waiting and by this feeling of being forgotten, of being left, of being abandoned by the international community.
2020 war returned to Western Sahara after the Polisario said that Morocco had violated the 30-year ceasefire agreement that the UN put in place in 1991. Then this war gets very, very little media coverage, part of that due to the fact that Morocco imposes a media blockade on Western Sahara. But for yourself and your family and, you know, the tens of thousands of Sahrawis that are living in the refugee camps, everyone is touched by this war in some way. Can you talk a bit about how this return to war has impacted you and your family?
My father just came back, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago from the front line, you know. Nobody wants to have their loved ones in an open fire zone, you know. My brother in 2022, my younger brother, he was a soldier and he almost got killed. His whole group, you know, I think four or five of them died in an instant in front of his eyes, you know. And six young men also died just this last January, bringing this fear. But what other options do we have in the table?
And this nonviolent resistance has been central to the Sahrawi struggle since 1975. But with the collapse of the ceasefire and now this war entering its fifth year, many Sahrawi youths have joined the Polisario as part of their commitment to the return to the armed struggle. Do you get a sense that there's a growing feeling that violence is now the only way to draw attention to this issue? I mean, what other paths for nonviolent resistance still exist and how viable are they?
You know, living in our reality of today, being directly impacted by the politics of today, it's a miracle to think that there is something that is nonviolent that could get you what you want. And it's the only language that seems to be at least heard is the language of violence, is the language of terrorism, is the language of anger, is the language of weapons, you know. So this is becoming the culture of our globe, you know. So, of course, we are part of this equation. Yet, I think that it is a miracle that these people in these refugee camps, even when they exercise violence, it's an organized violence. It's not violence, it's resistance, you know. Using weapons, it's not using terrorism, like there are no Sahrawis going and exploiting themselves in Rabat or like against some civilians in Morocco. It's people who are fighting, the soldiers who are fighting also at the same time. And I think, sadly, I still remember, I will never forget the day that the ceasefire broke. I was here in my house with, I think there were five or six young men. It was my brother, my younger brother, and his friends. And I was making coffee inside the kitchen, and I heard the phone call from a friend of my brother. And he said, "What are you doing sitting inside the house? The war started again." And he made a video call, WhatsApp video call, and he showed us live that the war started. All these young men ran out of the house and they were telling everybody. And all the young men in that afternoon of that day, they were in Rabuni, the headquarter of the camps, wanting to know how can they serve in this, you know, how can they contribute. I don't think it's a thirst for violence. I think it was a thirst for something happening, a change, you know, because you have to realize that these young people were born in a refugee camp. They were born waiting for something. Young people are just cynical of everything. They're just cynical, you know. They are reaching a point of no believing in nothing, you know. And especially you add the reality of the war in Gaza, the genocide in Gaza, the live genocide in Gaza, the horrible situation in Sudan. And then you just realize this is, this international politics is just, and I excuse my language, it's just BS, you know? They are like, where is the rule of law, you know? Where is all these things that we've been told years and years? And you have to realize this is population that is very politically aware, you know, very educated young people. You know, most of them went to university or at least finished high school, and a lot of them are following international news. I think the feeling here in the camps is cynical, and it's, I think, a huge deception, you know?
We'll be right back.
When King Charles made his first visit to Australia in 2024, his address to the Parliament went viral, from a PR perspective, for all the wrong reasons. The King was confronted by Indigenous Senator Lydia Thorpe, who reminded him that he was not, in fact, the sovereign of her nation. She also attempted to serve him with a writ for the crime of genocide addressed to the royal family. Dating back over 60,000 years, Indigenous civilization in Australia is one of the oldest on Earth. There were some 250 nations and more than 800 language groups before European colonization. None of these nations ever ceded sovereignty. Australia's founders never made any form of treaty with the First Peoples. But the voice of the white man still claims the history of Australia, telling stories that are often as violent as the genocide that established the country. Today, many argue that this genocide is ongoing. Top-down policies continue to deny Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people sovereignty. In this issue of New Internationalist, we trace centuries-old Indigenous claim to self-determination in Australia. We talk to those fighting for change within and outside the colonial system, examine the effects of Indigenous land rights in an era of resource extractivism, and consider the rallying call for treaty that is taking shape in parts of Australia. Subscribe to read the full issue via the link in our bio.
Unlike a lot of Sahrawis who have just been born and lived their whole lives in the camps, you've had a few opportunities to be able to travel abroad as part of political delegations. You mentioned that you studied in the US. Can you talk a bit about how you apply these international experiences and connections to your work back at home in the camps?
I was very privileged in many ways to have these opportunities to travel outside the camps, to study and to be the voice of the Sahrawi people, to be part of international delegations, youth delegations, women's delegations. I think it shaped my dedication and my obligation as a human rights activist. My obligation as a human, as an individual, is to fight for justice, you know, no matter what the price, and to always, always, always believe in justice and believe that justice is possible. Because it is very easy to fall into the trap of believing that there is no justice, you know. Mm-hmm. To always fall into this feeling of being cynical of the rule of law, of international law, and just think, oh, screw all of this. I'm just going to be an individual who look for my own interests, look for my own needs, and they don't care about the rest, which is something that you can easily fall into the reality of our world today. I have been hugely privileged, and this opportunity has shaped a lot of things in my life. But I think one of them is having this ability to connect with people outside here, and also to see that there is a common struggle, whether for Indigenous people in the U.S., Indigenous people in Canada, Indigenous people in Palestine, Indigenous people here in Africa. There's like, you find out that at the end of the day, the struggle is one and the enemy is one. It's this capitalistic white system, you know, and there is more that connect us as nations, even though if we're not together, even though if we're not at the same location, but we are connected.
And speaking of those international connections, the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg was in the camps in January, which I saw a lot of videos circulating and a lot of attention around her visit, which was really great to see, including this interview she did with Sahrawi Voice.
Have now gotten the chance to learn much more about the occupation, about life here in the refugee camps, how people have developed an extreme resilience during the last 50 years when people have been denied the right to return to their homelands.
Can you talk a bit about the work that you did with Greta while she was in the camps and what this, I mean, she's certainly not the first international activist to visit the camps, but can you talk a bit about what that is able to do for the Sahrawi cause when people like her come and show solidarity?
So she was participating in an international solidarity conference here in the camps, which was organized by two Swedish activists who have been biking from Japan to the camps the last 2 years and a half. So I was asked to be her companion while she's here. And we actually stayed in the same house, and I was just like her translator, and like I talked to her. I was like teaching her about the reality here in the camps. We had a combined workshop about climate change impact. I think her visit to the camps was really, really important to bring attention to the Sahrawi cause. But I think also that she realized that, as I said, the struggle is won, whether it's her struggle against climate change, whether it's the struggle of the Palestinian people, whether it's the struggle of the Sahrawi people. At the end, we are fighting the same thing, you know? And it is very, very, very important and crucial to make these connections and to make this solidarity among us, you know, as activists from different angles, from different locations, and to empower each other.
And I know from having been to the camps twice myself and been able to see, you know, what it means to be part of that solidarity movement and to actually meet and interact with people like yourself and, you know, even people who wouldn't necessarily call themselves activists. I think being part of it and being immersed with people there makes such a big difference. And it's so much, you feel so much more connected to a cause, obviously meeting people on the ground in person than you ever would just, you know, reading an academic paper about it or reading a news article about it. And I remember talking to you about the hospitality that we were shown when we were there, and just the kindness and the generosity of the Sahrawi community was just unlike anything I'd ever experienced before. And, you know, I remember you saying like, they go all out for visitors and that they treat guests so well, and that as a foreigner in the camps, you're presented with sort of the best that they have to offer, which is incredible. But I think also yourself as a Sahrawi, can you talk about what it is that draws you and the community together to the land and why it is so important to fight for that and to never give up on getting that land back?
I think we are one. You know, we are connected by the roots, by the blood, by the language, by the culture. As somebody who has traveled a lot, I left the camps, I came back to the camps. You know, it's like when I was growing up as a young girl, I was never in Western Sahara, you know, in the occupied territory of Western Sahara. I've never set a foot there. Yet, I feel connected to this place because of the stories that I was told, because of my grandmother, you know, my mom, she came when she was 6 years old. She still talks about this longing to go back. But my grandmother, she had an incredible role on creating this connection that I have with the land, you know, with the Sahrawi land. She would always, almost every day of her life when we were living here in the refugee camps, she would pray to God, oh, God, I wish to go back to my land. I wish to go back to the valleys. I wish to breathe the air of my land. This was the meaning of freedom to her. And she felt that this is her happiness. And sadly, she could never make it back home. And I think this also, like, it's more than just the longing for the land. It's like, it's the fact that how can you exist without a land? The Sahrawis have like hundreds of songs about their love to the land. They know every tree, every rock, every valley, every mountain, every piece of river, you know. And it's For you, maybe as a foreigner, when you go there, it's just a piece of land, you know, it's a desert. But to them, it's something deeper than just that. And of course, this is like, it's a huge connection. And I think this is the story of a lot of Native people. They have an incredible relationship with their roots and with their lands. This is our identity. This is our common identity. I am a Sahrawi. I was born as a Sahrawi. I grew up as a Sahrawi. And this entails a language, a history, a culture, a very beautiful culture that I don't want to change it for anything else.
And just as a final question, I want to bring it back to the Al-Masar Library Center that you founded. When you look ahead at what is possible for this center and what you want to do with it, and for those that are listening to you speak, and perhaps this is the first that they've ever heard of the Sahrawi struggle, or you know, the most direct kind of account of the struggle that they've heard, what are some of your dreams for this center? What do you hope that it can be? And how can people support you to achieve those dreams?
I think my aspiration for this center is to reach more people, to have more capacity to serve more children and more women in the camps. My hope is that we can expand the space to make it bigger, because our space is very small. We cannot fit all the children who wish to come. So this is one. And then to basically make our health program, women's health program, more accessible to all women around the camps, not only restricted to the women in the camp of Smara. We are at a point where we need some agency over what we eat, even though we are in a refugee camp, you know, because if we don't have any other alternatives to this humanitarian aid, it will be a catastrophic, you know. And I think the Sahrawis are equipped if they find the right resources and the right guidance to grow food. I think one of the best things to do as someone who's listening to me is to visit this place, you know, because there is an incredible amount of propaganda out there about the refugee camps, about the Sahrawi struggle. So one of the things that you can help to do to help these people and to help me is to raise awareness and to educate yourself and to be our voice. So I hope people, if they listen to this, they would learn more about this cause, and because it's really forgotten. It's really, really forgotten. And it's tragic that a lot of people around the world have no idea about this. And it shouldn't be like this, you know? Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be like this.
Yeah. Well, I know it's getting very late for you now, and I'm very glad the internet has held, so it's been a nice, clear conversation. But thank you so much, Najla. I mean, I am just always in awe of you, and I'm so grateful that we were able to properly record this for the podcast. So thank you so much for making the time. I know it took 4 tries, but we got there in the end.
You're very welcome.
That was Najla Mohamed Lamine, a women's rights and climate activist and the founder of the Al-Masar Library Center. Please check our show notes for links to further reading on everything you heard today, including details on how to support the Al-Masar Library Center. And if you don't already, please consider subscribing to New Internationalist using the discount code TheWorldUnspun at checkout for 20% off the first year of your print and/or digital subscription. That's it from us. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I'm your host and producer, Maxine Betteridge-Mose, and I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Bethany Riley, Conrad Landon, and Nick Dowson. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Foos. Audio editing is by Naseek Hamza. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.